Welcome to Tastes of the Tropics. And now, here are your hosts, Gretchen Schmidt and Christina Favretto.
In South Florida, the name of plant explorer David Fairchild is familiar to many of us. Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden was named after him. His Coconut Grove estate, the Campong, is today a part of the National Tropical Botanic Garden, where you can see his fruit trees and what his laboratory looked like. There's a David Fairchild Elementary School. We might be growing Fairchild mangoes in our backyard. But for the rest of the country, David Fairchild's legacy might be most apparent by what's on your dinner plate. Kale and mango and seedless grapes and dates and citrus and so much more. Fairchild is credited with introducing perhaps 200,000 plants and crops to the United States more than 100 years ago. With us today is Daniel Stone, author of The Food Explorer, The True Adventures of the Globe-Trotting Botanist Who Transformed What America Eats. And our special guest is David Fairchild's granddaughter, Helene Pancoast, who lives in Coconut Grove. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. David, start out by telling us what got you interested in telling his story.
I had been interested in botany and plants all my life and farming. About 5 years ago, I heard about an adventure botanist named David Fairchild, and that title alone was so fantastic that I wanted to find out more. And I found his journals, I found his archive, I found his family who had personal recollections, and altogether it built this portrait of a remarkable man who had a transformative effect on our food.
Helene, how many years ago was it that you hung out at the Campong with your grandfather and helped him out doing what he was doing with fruits? Tell us a little bit about what you remember.
It was our playground. Campong was our playground, and we spent Sundays over there. We were allowed to leave our house, which is about 2 blocks away, and go to the Campong and just play there all day. And then my mother would come and cook dinner, and the whole family would get together. So Granddaddy was very much part of our lives. You know, we swam together, he told stories, and we learned a lot about how to treat people. He was Quaker. And one reason he was so careful with people is because that's part of the Quaker being. But he was fun. He just was fun to be around. He would say, I can see such and such. Can you see it? So he taught us also to look, to be able to see things in our surroundings. Pick them out. A little wiggle of a leaf over there. There's something wiggling that leaf. And so we had to learn what it was. And we better catch it and better, in our eyes and get it right. Or we got, you know. And then there was the situation with the hand lenses. He handed out hand lenses to kids so they could learn to see things in a different scale. And he thought that was very, very important, that you begin to learn to look at things carefully. But it was just fun to be around. They both were.
Now, I understand he put the grandchildren to work, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. At a time when fruits were ready to be shipped, the lower part of the packing house, the study, was a packing house, and we were all put to work there. We made sure that the fruit were complete, no soft spots, that they had the name written on them. They were packed, and then a truck came, picked them up, and they went into the railroad station and off. But our responsibility was to be there and help packing. It was fun.
Now, what's remarkable about these stories Helen is telling is this is toward the end of David Fairchild's. This is in his older age. He had these qualities and he had developed these processes of selecting plants, of selecting the best fruits, of packing them, of shipping them. This was a lifelong effort for him, and he got better and better at it as he got older. And, he did this from every corner of the world in search of every type of food. Avocados, kale, types of citrus, like you mentioned, seedless grapes. I mean, these are very different types of crops, and he managed to successfully introduce brand new varieties that had enormous impact in the U.S.
And that in itself was a lot of work, because the shipping of plant materials was difficult. First of all, you had to make sure they were clean. And they got into trouble with the cherry trees in Japan, is well known, but he was very, very cautious about that anything he shipped was carefully prepared, that the seeds were dry before they got put in things, because Otherwise, they didn't work. They'd get them here after all that work, and they wouldn't grow because they were dead. So that was a whole new technology they had to develop.
Now, in your book, you start at the very beginning, and it's interesting to see that as a very young man, his progress, and he came from the Midwest. Tell us a little bit about David Fairchild's early days as you researched.
Sure. This is a young boy who grows up first in Michigan and then in Kansas. His father is a university professor, but he's surrounded by farmers, by people growing things, and a lot of them are growing the same things. There's a lot of corn, there's a lot of potatoes, there's meat, livestock, dairy, right? Not a lot of diversity. And that leads eventually to an agricultural depression. Too many people growing all the same things, no one's making any money. He saw this and he combined it with his two passions, which were plants and adventure. And he finds his way to Washington and he finds a way to work for the USDA. And eventually, a series of chance encounters and good luck and great effort, he finds a way to travel on behalf of the U.S. government and paid by the U.S. government and a wealthy friend of his, a benefactor, to do this work. But, you know, this didn't happen over a week. It didn't happen over a year. This was a long effort that he was going toward those same passions, plants and adventure.
Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to consider that this was over 100 years ago, when transportation was certainly a much more involved, time-consuming process than it is right now, and yet, but he found his way to so many exotic places. Yeah. Talk about some of his adventures there.
Sure. He went to more than 50 countries, all of them by boat. His first trip was to Italy, where he gets an apprenticeship with the Smithsonian. Then he goes to Java on the other side of the world. He travels around South Asia to Fiji, which are then the Cannibal Isles. He goes to every continent and picks up plants over the next 15 years. You know, this is a period known as the Golden Age of Travel, but travel wasn't illustrious, it wasn't easy, and it wasn't fast. And he would spend weeks, sometimes months, on steamships, not always in the highest of luxury, in pursuit of landing in a faraway land that no one like him had ever visited. And nothing like he found had ever been collected. And he did this over and over and got better and better at it as he progressed.
Now, he's not the only one, although he's the focus of the story. There are some other names in this that we've heard before. Walter Swingle was one of them.
Sure.
Frank Meyer was the other one, whose story seems to warrant another book, because share a little bit about their experiences in plant exploring.
Walter Swingle, who went by the name Tenny, right? Walter Tennyson Swingle was a friend of David Fairchild while they grew up in Kansas. And they both followed the very similar path to Washington to work for the USDA and eventually travel for the government. David Fairchild travels for about 10, 15 years. He gets married. He stops the kinetic travel in the same way, and he slows down a little bit. And while he does that, he hires a team of other young men to continue on this work. One is named Wilson Popeno, who looks for avocados in Guatemala. Mm-hmm. Another looks for wheat in Russia. Mm-hmm. And the third is Frank Meyer, who is a young Dutch immigrant, comes to the U.S., very bright-eyed. He loves plants and he loves to walk long distances. And Fairchild sends him to China to quite literally walk across China in search of some of the hardiest plant varieties in the world. Meyer has incredible, harrowing, amazing adventures in China. He is threatened, he is robbed, he is celebrated. No one's ever seen a white man in some of the places he visits. And he brings back, in his own part, thousands of crops. He brings back a pair of monkeys at one point. His crops were mainly soybeans and persimmons and pears and peaches and apples. But he also brings back a special type of lemon that's a natural hybrid between a lemon and an orange that we call today the Meyer lemon. That's a favorite of people like Martha Stewart and Alice Waters.
His adventures, though, it seems, sort of cost him his life.
Yeah, Meyer is very much a man of circumstance. And like I said, he's a very optimistic young man. But as he's walking in China, China's entering a revolution, its cultural revolution of 1911, right around the same time that the West is entering World War I. And this de-evolution of humanity, of the world, of seeing things almost fall apart, really leaves him depressed and despondent. And Meyer continues, and Fairchild continues to encourage him and cheer him up through their letters they sent back and forth. But eventually, yeah, Meyer is hopeless, and he wants to come home, and he disappears one night off of a steamer on the Yangtze River. And David Fairchild and the USDA and everyone since has long considered it a mystery.
Right. It's inconclusive. Right. Did he fall off? Did he jump?
You know, there's very little evidence about that night. Certainly none that I could go back and look. He had every reason to just be hopeless about the world, but
it's a mystery.
Yeah, I wasn't there, and people who were didn't write it down, so we don't know.
On a sort of more cheerful note, one of the things that I noticed in the story was that as a very young man, David Fairchild seemed very involved in his work and perhaps sort of socially maybe awkward, mm-hmm. but that changed. Mm-hmm. And his courtship, you spend a little time speaking of his courtship, and it's very sweet and it's very charming. What stories did you hear, Helene, about your grandparents, or did they talk about growing up? Because it seems very touching.
Granddaddy's was laid back, and he was quiet. There again, that's the Quaker training. And the Bell family was more outgoing, but Gammy Bell being deaf, it made her different. But when we all went to Bedeck, and this continues to this day, the family gathers in Canada. It is a whole big family, and everybody loves everybody. It doesn't love, but takes care of everybody else. And it's that kind of a family. It always has been. And it's nice to know that we were fortunate enough to be able to be in that family.
I guess.
It was never dull.
I can imagine. Back to the plant part of it, some of the things we know about that, and 200,000, is that a figure that I've seen different things, 170, but whatever it is, it's more than one can fathom the varieties of plants that were incorporated, whether as food or useful plants,
right,
too. I know that encompasses a lot there. But what is interesting is that I was surprised to discover a few that didn't seem to take in this country until many years later. Quinoa was one of those. Mm-hmm. Now, in the last few years, quinoa is a superfood, but he brought it back here, but it looks like it didn't gain any traction.
Yeah, it didn't. Quinoa is botanically a very confusing food. It grows leaves like spinach, and it has a grain that's not a grain. It's a protein. No one really knew how to cook it. No one really wanted to taste it and try it. I mean, really, quinoa's rise, modern rise, contemporary, is a result of new nutrition research showing what's inside and marketing to try to get this food more visibility. That's true with many of the foods we eat. But 100 years ago, it was just before its time. Similar case with kale. I mean, kale is not a fruit of great allure, right? It is not a food of a great resume. It gets here, and in the 1980s and 1990s, it undergoes that same nutritional research and that similar marketing. And that's why kale went from its first days as kind of a foliage in salad bars, right?
And it was decorative.
Yeah, decorative, you know, ornamental. Yeah, and now it's, you know, the stuff of hipsters in Brooklyn, and no one can get enough kale, right? That's not an accident. He would say, and I think Helen would agree, he had a lot of successes, but there were a lot of things that didn't work, right? He's finding plants on the other side of the world, making assumptions about their climate and a similar climate back in the U.S. And he was right sometimes, but he was also, he called some wrong. One is the chayote pear. It's a vegetable pear of the Caribbean that he thought people would enjoy, and it didn't find consumers. One of his biggest disappointments was the mangosteen, which he found in South Asia, was one of his favorite fruits of his life.
That's true.
And if you've ever tried one, it is delicious, indescribably delicious. But it has a very thick skin. It bruises very easily. It ripens very fast. And no one quite knows how to eat it. So it has a very thin resume compared to a fruit like the orange or the apple, bananas, things that really have withstood the test of time, distance, and shelf life.
But I must say that we are not tropical enough for mangosteen, but some of our rare fruit aficionados here in South Florida are growing it, getting it to fruit. And places like Robert is here in Homestead, they're bringing it in from elsewhere. So they're cultivating a market for it here. We know that folks, the Asian folks know about it and love it, but Americans don't. But they're commanding like a high price for it. So who knows?
Which is great. And that is the function of globalization of food, that now people learn about new plants a lot more easily than they did 100 years ago. Things can be shipped a lot faster. Markets can be established through marketing a lot easier. So I wouldn't be surprised if 10 years from now we have mangosteens in our supermarkets.
And the other factor was frozen food. I mean, that was something, when it came in, they would send things to the family and we'd be there for dinner on Sunday night and we would serve frozen vegetables. And granted, I said, this is the future because these taste better than when they've traveled for 2 weeks by train from California. Mm-hmm. So the freezing industry also made it, opened a whole new way to present these things where they could be kept longer than if they were in, you know, just shipped.
Or preserved or turned into something else.
Exactly.
Now, there was a downside, and it remains a downside, which has to do with invasive species.
Yes.
And we don't have time to get into it, but your book certainly does. The obstacles that he ran into bringing in all the plant introductions and the potential problems. You mentioned before what happened with the Japanese cherry trees when they came in here. Talk a little bit about the downside to bringing in plants from other
sure.
places.
It's a valid concern to wonder when you're bringing plants across oceans to places they've never grown before, what they could be bringing with them in the form of insects, pests, and fungi that have never existed and could wreak real damage. Fairchild was concerned about this, but he was always in favor of the broad benefits of these plants. There was a friend of his named Charles Marlatt who worked in the USDA also. He was an entomologist. And the two of them were friends, but had reasonable disagreements about the role of these new plants and the dangers they caused. This first really appeared with the cherry blossom trees. Fairchild wanted the trees as a diplomatic symbol of a friendship between the US and Japan. Marlatt didn't want them because he didn't know what they would bring. And Marlatt was initially proven right when the first shipment of trees were teeming with insects and types of scale insects that could be very damaging. They were burned on the National Mall. A photo on the cover of the New York Times was printed, and it was a disaster. It was a diplomatic disaster. Fairchild held the relationship together. He arranged for a second shipment of trees. Those are the ones in Washington, D.C. today. But that disagreement never went away. And frankly, it still exists in where we get plants, what they bring, and the assumptions we make about what types of plants will grow here without thinking too much about the damage they may cause.
And we certainly see that in South Florida when in the Everglades they planted Melaleuca back in the 1920s, and now it's all we can do to eradicate it. But it seems also 100 years later, are there more plants left to explore in the world? Can there be a modern day plant explorer, or is that role something different?
I really don't know.
I think someone like David Fairchild, there is no capacity for that sort of adventure. His work was very risky and the potential for reward was very slim. And he was willing to accept that bargain. Nowadays, we have multinational seed companies. They minimize their risk and maximize the potential reward. And so the equation has flipped quite a bit. Botanists still go all around the world looking for these crops. They don't really have the Fairchild method of Fairchild combination of smarts and kindness mm-hmm. and diplomacy and really a tolerance for, you know, culture all over the world in a way that was very rare in his era and contributed to making him truly remarkable for a man of his moment.
And he brought in more than commercial things. He brought in because they were beautiful and they smelled good. That was also the part of Gammy's thing was, David, may not have decent fruit, but his flowers are absolutely exquisite. So he brought in a lot of things just because they were nice.
And our world is much richer and much more delicious because of him. I want to thank both of you. Daniel, thank you very much. The book is called The Food Explorer, The True Adventures of the Globetrotting Botanist Who Transformed What America Eats by Daniel Stone. Helene Pancoast, thank you so much for being part of our podcast.
My pleasure.
This is Gretchen Schmidt with Edible South Florida, and you've been listening to Tastes of the Tropics.
Thanks for listening to Tastes of the Tropics with Gretchen Schmidt and Christina Favretto on Edible Radio. For more information, visit ediblecommunities.com. This podcast is a production of Edible Radio, all rights reserved.